to cover the loss which is constantly arising from the superseding of machines before they are worn out by others of a new and better construction. End of footnote. In both cases, be the machine ever so young and full of life, its value is no longer determined by the labour actually materialised in it, but by the labour time requisite to reproduce either it or the better machine. It has, therefore, lost value more or less. The shorter the period taken to reproduce its total value, the less is the danger of moral depreciation, and the longer the working day, the shorter is that period. When machinery is first introduced into an industry, new methods of reproducing it more cheaply follow blow upon blow, and so do improvements that not only affect the individual parts and details of the machine, but its entire build. Footnote. It has been estimated, roughly, that the first individual of a newly invented machine will cost about 5 times as much as the construction of the second. Babbage. End of footnote. It is, therefore, in the early days of the life of machinery that this special incentive to the prolongation of the working day makes itself felt most acutely. Footnote. The improvements which took place not long ago in frames for making patent net were so great that a machine in good repair which had cost £1,200 sold a few years after for £60. Improvements succeeded each other so rapidly that machines which had never been finished were abandoned in the hands of their makers because new improvements had superseded their utility. Babbage. In these stormy go-ahead times, therefore, the tool manufacturers soon extended the working day by means of double sets of hands from the original 8 hours to 24. End of footnote. Given the length of the working day, all other circumstances remaining the same, the exploitation of double the number of workmen demands not only a doubling of that part of constant capital which is invested in machinery and buildings, but also of that part which is laid out in raw material and auxiliary substances. The lengthening of the working day, on the other hand, allows of production on an extended scale without any alteration in the amount of capital laid out on machinery and buildings. Footnote. It is self-evident that, amid the ebbings and flowings of the markets, and the alternate expansions and contractions of demand, occasions will constantly recur in which the manufacturer may employ additional floating capital without employing additional fixed capital, if additional quantities of raw material can be worked up without incurring an additional expense for buildings and machinery. R. Torrens, On Wages and Combination, London, 1834. End of footnote. Not only is there, therefore, an increase of surplus value, but the outlay necessary to obtain it diminishes. It is true that this takes place more or less with every lengthening of the working day, but in the case under consideration, the change is more marked, because the capital converted into the instruments of labour preponderates to a greater degree. Footnote. This circumstance is mentioned only for the sake of completeness, for I shall not consider the rate of profit, that is, the ratio of the surplus value to the total capital advanced, until I come to the third book. End of footnote. The development of the factory system fixes a constantly increasing portion of the capital in a form in which, on the one hand, its value is capable of continual self-expansion, and in which, on the other hand, it loses both use value and exchange value whenever it loses contact with living labour. When a labourer, says Mr. Ashworth, a cotton magnate, to Professor Nathau W. Sr., lays down his spade, he renders useless for that period a capital worth 18 pence. When one of our people leaves the mill, he renders useless a capital that has cost £100,000. Footnote. Senior, Letters on the Factory Act, London, 1837. End of footnote. Only fancy, making useless for a single moment a capital that has cost £100,000. It is in truth monstrous that a single one of our people should ever leave the factory. The increased use of machinery, as Senior after the instruction he received from Ashworth clearly perceives, makes a constantly increasing lengthening of the working day desirable. Footnote. The great proportion of fixed to circulating capital makes long hours of work desirable. With the increased use of machinery, etc., the motives to long hours of work will become greater, as the only means by which a large proportion of fixed capital can be made profitable. There are certain expenses upon a mill which go on in the same proportion whether the mill be running short or full time, as, for instance, rent rates and taxes, insurance against fire, wages of several permanent servants, deterioration of machinery, with various other charges upon a manufacturing establishment, the proportion of which to profits increases as the production decreases. Reports of Inspector of Factories for the 31st of October 1862. End of footnote. Machinery produces relative surplus value, not only by directly depreciating the value of labour power and by indirectly cheapening the same through cheapening the commodities that enter into its reproduction, but also, when it is first introduced sporadically into an industry, by converting the labour employed by the owner of that machinery into labour of a higher degree and greater efficacy, by raising the social value of the article produced above its individual value, and thus enabling the capitalist to replace the value of a day's labour power by a smaller proportion of the value of a day's product. During this transition period, when the use of machinery is a sort of monopoly, the profits are therefore exceptional, and the capitalist endeavours to exploit thoroughly the sunny time of this his first love, by prolonging the working day as much as possible. The magnitude of the profit whets his appetite for more profit. As the use of machinery becomes more general in a particular industry, the social value of the product sinks down to its individual value, and the law that surplus value does not arise from the labour power that has been replaced by the machinery, but from the labour power actually employed in working with the machinery, asserts itself. Surplus value arises from variable capital alone, and we saw that the amount of surplus value depends on two factors, viz. The rate of surplus value and the number of the workmen simultaneously employed. Given the length of the working day, the rate of surplus value is determined by the relative duration of the necessary labour and of the surplus labour in a day. The number of the labourers simultaneously employed depends, on its side, on the ratio of the variable to the constant capital. Now, however much the use of machinery may increase the surplus labour at the expense of the necessary labour, by heightening the productiveness of labour, it is clear that it attains this result only by diminishing the number of workmen employed by a given amount of capital. It converts what was formerly variable capital, invested in labour power, into machinery, which, being constant capital, does not produce surplus value. It is impossible, for instance, to squeeze as much surplus value out of 2 as out of 24 labourers. If each of these 24 men gives only 1 hour of surplus labour in 12, the 24 men give together 24 hours of surplus labour, while 24 hours is the total labour of the two men. Hence, the application of machinery to the production of surplus value implies a contradiction which is immanent in it, since of the two factors of the surplus value created by a given amount of capital, one, the rate of surplus value, cannot be increased except by diminishing the other, the number of workmen. This contradiction comes to light as soon as by the general employment of machinery in a given industry the value of the machine-produced commodity regulates the value of all commodities of the same sort. And it is this contradiction that, in its turn, drives the capitalist, without his being conscious of the fact, to excessive lengthening of the working day, in order that he may compensate the decrease in the relative number of labourers exploited by an increase not only of the relative, but of the absolute surplus labour. Footnote. Why it is that the capitalist and also the political economist who are imbued with his views are unconscious of this imminent contradiction will appear from the first part of the third book. End of footnote. If, then, the capitalist employment of machinery on the one hand supplies new and powerful motives to an excessive lengthening of the working day and radically changes as well the methods of labour as also the character of the social working organism in such a manner as to break down all opposition to this tendency, on the other hand, it produces, partly by opening out to the capitalist new strata of the working class previously inaccessible to him, partly by setting free the labourers it supplants, a surplus working population, which is compelled to submit to the dictation of capital. Footnote. It is one of the greatest merits of Ricardo to have seen in machinery not only the means of producing commodities, but of creating a redundant population. End of footnote. Hence that remarkable phenomenon in the history of modern industry, that machinery sweeps away every moral and natural restriction on the length of the working day. Hence, too, the economic paradox that the most powerful instrument for shortening labour time becomes the most unfailing means for placing every moment of the labourer's time and that of his family at the disposal of the capitalist for the purpose of expanding the value of his capital. If, dreamed Aristotle, the greatest thinker of antiquity, if every tool, when summoned, or even of its own accord, could do the work that befits it, just as the creations of Daedalus moved of themselves, or the tripods of Hephaestus went of their own accord to their sacred work, if the weavers' shuttles were to weave of themselves, then there would be no need either of apprentices for the master workers, or of slaves for the lords. Footnote. F. Bise, Die Philosophie des Aristoteles. Volume 2, Berlin, 1842. End of footnote. And Antipatros, a Greek poet of the time of Cicero, hailed the invention of the water wheel for grinding corn, an invention that is the elementary form of all machinery, as the giver of freedom to female slaves and the bringer back of the Golden Age. Footnote. I give here the translation of this poem by Stolberg, because it brings into relief, quite in the spirit of former quotations referring to division of labour, the antithesis between the views of the ancients and the moderns. Spare the hand that grinds the corn, O miller girls, and softly sleep. Let Chanticleer announce the morn in vain. Deo has commanded the work of the girls to be done by the nymphs, and now they skip lightly over the wheels, so that the shaken axles revolve with their spokes and pull round the load of the revolving stones. Let us live the life of our fathers, and let us rest from work, and enjoy the gifts that the goddess sends us. End of footnote. Oh, those heathens! They understood, as the learned Bastiat, and before him the still wiser McCulloch have discovered, nothing of political economy and Christianity. They did not, for example, comprehend that machinery is the surest means of lengthening the working day. They perhaps excused the slavery of one on the ground that it was a means to the full development of another. But to preach slavery of the masses in order that a few crude and half-educated parvenus might become eminent spinners, extensive sausage-makers, and influential shoeblack dealers. To do this, they lacked the bump of Christianity. C. Intensification of labour. The immoderate lengthening of the working day, produced by machinery in the hands of capital, leads to a reaction on the part of society, the very sources of whose life are menaced, and thence to a normal working day whose length is fixed by law. Thenceforth, a phenomenon that we have already met with, namely the intensification of labour, develops into great importance. Our analysis of absolute surplus value had reference primarily to the extension or duration of the labour, its intensity being assumed as given. We now proceed to consider the substitution of a more intensified labour for labour of more extensive duration, and the degree of the former. It is self-evident that in proportion as the use of machinery spreads and the experience of a special class of workmen habituated to machinery accumulates, the rapidity and intensity of labour increase as a natural consequence. Thus, in England, during half a century, lengthening of the working day went hand in hand with increasing intensity of factory labour. Nevertheless, the reader will clearly see that where we have labour not carried on by fits and starts, but repeated day after day with unvarying uniformity, a point must inevitably be reached where extension of the working day and intensity of the labour mutually exclude one another, in such a way that lengthening of the working day becomes compatible only with a lower degree of intensity, and a higher degree of intensity only with a shortening of the working day. So soon as the gradually surging revolt of the working class compelled Parliament to shorten compulsorily the hours of labour and to begin by imposing a normal working day on factories proper, so soon, consequently, as an increased production of surplus value by the prolongation of the working day was once and for all put a stop to, from that moment capital threw itself with all its might into the production of relative surplus value, by hastening on the further improvement of machinery. At the same time, a change took place in the nature of relative surplus value. Generally speaking, the mode of producing relative surplus value consists in raising the productive power of the workman, so as to enable him to produce more in a given time with the same expenditure of labour. Labour time continues to transmit, as before, the same value to the total product, but this unchanged amount of exchange value is spread over more use value. Hence, the value of each single commodity sinks. Otherwise, however, so soon as the compulsory shortening of the hours of labour takes place, the immense impetus it gives the development of productive power and to economy in the means of production imposes on the workman increased expenditure of labour in a given time, heightened tension of labour power, and closer filling up of the pores of the working day, or condensation of labour to a degree that is attainable only within the limits of the shortened working day. This condensation of a greater mass of labour into a given period thenceforward counts for what it really is, a greater quantity of labour. In addition to a measure of its extension, that is, duration, labour now acquires a measure of its intensity, or of the degree of its condensation or density. Footnote. There are, of course, always differences in the intensities of the labour in various industries, but these differences are, as Adam Smith has shown, compensated to a partial extent by minor circumstances peculiar to each sort of labour. Labour time, as a measure of value, is not, however, affected in this case, except insofar as the duration of labour and the degree of its intensity are two antithetical and mutually exclusive expressions for one and the same quantity of labour. End of footnote. The denser hour of the 10 hours working day contains more labour, that is, expended labour power, than the more porous hour of the 12 hours working day. The product, therefore, of one of the former hours has as much or more value than has the product of 1 1/5 of the latter hours. Apart from the increased yield of relative surplus value through its heightened productiveness of labour, the same mass of value is now produced for the capitalist, say, by 3 1/3 hours of surplus labour and 6 2/3 hours of necessary labour, as was previously produced by 4 hours of surplus labour and 8 hours of necessary labour. We now come to the question, how is the labour intensified? The first effect of shortening the working day results from the self-evident law that the efficiency of labour power is in an inverse ratio to the duration of its expenditure. Hence, within certain limits, what is lost by shortening the duration is gained by the increasing tension of labour power. That the workman, moreover, really does expend more labour power is ensured by the mode in which the capitalist pays him. Footnote. Especially by piecework, a form we shall investigate in Part 6 of this book. End of footnote. In those industries, such as potteries, where machinery plays little or no part, the introduction of the factory acts has strikingly shown that the mere shortening of the working day increases to a wonderful degree the regularity, uniformity, order, continuity, and energy of the labour. Footnote. See Reports of Inspectors of Factories for 31st of October, 1865. It seemed, however, doubtful whether this effect was produced in the factory proper, where the dependence of the workman on the continuous and uniform motion of the machinery had already created the strictest discipline. Hence, when in 1844 the reduction of the working day to less than 12 hours was being debated, the masters almost unanimously declared that their overlookers in the different rooms took good care that the hands lost no time, that the extent of vigilance and attention on the part of the workmen was hardly capable of being increased, and therefore that the speed of the machinery and other conditions remaining unaltered. To expect, in a well-managed factory, any important result from increased attention of the workmen was an absurdity. Footnote. Reports of Inspector of Factories for 1844 and the quarter ending 30th of April, 1845. End of footnote. This assertion was contradicted by experiments. Mr. Robert Gardner reduced the hours of labour in his two large factories at Preston, on and after the 20th of April, 1844, from 12 to 11 hours a day. The result of about a year's working was that the same amount of product for the same cost was received, and the workpeople as a whole earned in 11 hours as much wages as they did before in 12. Footnote. Since the wages for piecework were unaltered, the weekly wages depended on the quantity produced. End of footnote. I pass over the experiments made in the spinning and carding rooms, because they were accompanied by an increase of 2% in the speed of the machines. But in the weaving department, where, moreover, many sorts of figured fancy articles were woven, there was not the slightest alteration in the conditions of the work. The result was, from the 6th of January to the 20th of April, 1844, with a 12 hours day, average weekly wages of each hand, 10 shillings and a penny halfpenny. From the 20th of April to 29th of June, 1844, with day of 11 hours, average weekly wages, 10 shillings, and 3/2 halfpenny. Here we have more produced in 11 hours than previously in 12, and entirely in consequence of more steady application and economy of time by the workpeople. While they got the same wages and gained 1 hour of spare time, the capitalist got the same amount produced and saved the cost of coal, gas, and other such items for 1 hour. Similar experiments, and with the like success, were carried out in the mills of Messrs. Horrocks and Jackson. Footnote. The moral element played an important part in the above experiments. The workpeople told the factory inspector, "We work with more spirit. We have the reward ever before us of getting away sooner at night. And one active and cheerful spirit pervades the whole mill, from the youngest piecer to the oldest hand, and we can greatly help each other." End of footnote. The shortening of the hours of labour creates, to begin with, the subjective conditions for the condensation of labour by enabling the workman to exert more strength in a given time. So soon as that shortening becomes compulsory, machinery becomes, in the hands of capital, the objective means systematically employed for squeezing out more labour in a given time. This is effected in two ways, by increasing the speed of the machinery and by giving the workman more machinery to tend. Improved construction of the machinery is necessary, partly because without it, greater pressure cannot be put on the workman, and partly because the shortened hours of labour force the capitalist to exercise the strictest watch over the cost of production. The improvements in the steam engine have increased the piston speed, and at the same time have made it possible, by means of a greater economy of power, to drive with the same or even smaller consumption of coal more machinery with the same engine. The improvements in the transmitting mechanism have lessened friction, and what so strikingly distinguishes modern from the older machinery have reduced the diameter and weight of the shafting to a constantly decreasing minimum. Finally, the improvements in the operative machines have, while reducing their size, increased their speed and efficiency, as in the modern power loom, or while increasing the size of their framework, have also increased the extent and number of their working parts, as in spinning mules, or have added to the speed of these working parts by imperceptible alterations of detail, such as those which 10 years ago increased the speed of the spindles in self-acting mules by 1/5. The reduction of the working day to 12 hours dates in England from 1832. In 1836, a manufacturer stated, "The labour now undergone in the factories is much greater than it used to be, compared with 30 or 40 years ago, owing to the greater attention and activity required by the greatly increased speed which is given to the machinery." Footnote. John Fielden. End of footnote. In the year 1844, Lord Ashley, now Lord Shaftesbury, made in the House of Commons the following statements, supported by documentary evidence. "The labour performed by those engaged in the process of manufacture is 3 times as great as in the beginning of such operations. Machinery has executed, no doubt, the work that would demand the sinews of millions of men, but it has also prodigiously multiplied the labour of those who are governed by its fearful movements. In 1815, the labour of following a pair of mules spinning cotton of number 40, reckoning 12 hours to the working day, involved a necessity of walking 8 miles. In 1832, the distance travelled in following a pair of mules spinning cotton yarn of the same number was 20 miles, and frequently more. In 1815, the spinner put up daily, on each of these mules, 820 stretches, making a total of 1,640 stretches in the course of the day. In 1832, the spinner put up on each mule 2,200 stretches, making a total of 4,400. In 1844, 2,400 stretches, making a total of 4,800, and in some cases the amount of labour required is even still greater. I have another document sent to me in 1842, stating that the labour is progressively increasing not only because the distance to be travelled is greater, but because the quantity of goods produced is multiplied, while the hands are fewer in proportion than before, and moreover, because an inferior species of cotton is now often spun, which it is more difficult to work. In the carding room there has also been a great increase of labour. One person there does the work formerly divided between two. In the weaving room, where a vast number of persons are employed, and principally females, the labour has increased within the last few years fully 10%, owing to the increased speed of the machinery and spinning. In 1838, the number of hanks spun per week was 18,000. In 1843, it amounted to 21,000. In 1819, the number of picks in power loom weaving per minute was 60. In 1842, it was 140, showing a vast increase of labour. In the face of this remarkable intensity of labour, which had already been reached in 1844 under the 12 Hours Act, there appeared to be a justification for the assertion made at that time by the English manufacturers that any further progress in that direction was impossible, and therefore that every further reduction of the hours of labour meant a lessened production. The apparent correctness of their reasons will be best shown by the following contemporary statement by Leonard Horner, the factory inspector, their ever-watchful censor. "Now, as the quantity produced must in the main be regulated by the speed of the machinery, it must be the interest of the mill-owner to drive it at the utmost rate of speed consistent with these following conditions, viz., the preservation of the machinery from too rapid deterioration, the preservation of the quality of the article manufactured, and the capability of the workman to follow the motion without a greater exertion than he can sustain for a constancy. One of the most important problems, therefore, which the owner of a factory has to solve, is to find out the maximum speed at which he can run, with a due regard to the above conditions. It frequently happens that he finds he has gone too fast, that breakages and bad work more than counterbalance the increased speed, and that he is obliged to slacken his pace. I therefore concluded that as an active and intelligent mill-owner would find out the safe maximum, it would not be possible to produce as much in 11 hours as in 12. I further assumed that the operative paid by piecework would exert himself to the utmost, consistent with the power of continuing at the same rate. Footnote. Reports of Inspector of Factories, 30th of September, 1844, end of footnote. Horner, therefore, came to the conclusion that a reduction of the working hours below 12 would necessarily diminish production. He himself, 10 years later, cites his opinion of 1845 in proof of how much he underestimated in that year the elasticity of machinery and of man's labour power, both of which are simultaneously stretched to an extreme by the compulsory shortening of the working day. We now come to the period that follows the introduction of the 10 Hours Act in 1847 into the English cotton, woolen, silk and flax mills. The speed of the spindles has increased upon throstles 500 and upon mules 1,000 revolutions a minute, that is, the speed of the throstle spindle, which in 1839 was 4,500 times a minute, is now, 1862, 5,000. And of the mule spindle, that was 5,000, is now 6,000 times a minute, amounting in the former case to 1/10 and in the second case to 1/5, additional increase. Footnote. Reports of Inspector of Factories for 31st of October, 1862. End of footnote. James Naismith, the eminent civil engineer of Patricroft, near Manchester, explained in a letter to Leonard Horner, written in 1852, the nature of the improvements in the steam engine that had been made between the years 1848 and 1852. After remarking that the horsepower of steam engines, being always estimated in the official returns according to the power of similar engines in 1828, is only nominal, and can serve only as an index of their real power, he goes on to say, I am confident that from the same weight of steam engine machinery, we are now obtaining at least 50% more duty or work performed on the average, and that in many cases the identical steam engines, which in the days of the restricted speed of 220 feet per minute yielded 50 horsepower, are now yielding upwards of 100. The modern steam engine of 100 horsepower is capable of being driven at a much greater force than formerly, arising from improvements in its construction, the capacity and construction of the boilers, etc. Footnote. In the Parliamentary Return of 1862, the actual horsepower of the modern steam engines and water wheels appears in place of the nominal. The doubling spindles, too, are no longer included in the spinning spindles, as was the case in the returns of 1839, 1850, and 1856. Further, in the case of woolen mills, the number of gigs is added, a distinction made between jute and hemp mills on the one hand and flax mills on the other, and finally, stocking weaving is for the first time inserted in the report. End of footnote. Although the same number of hands are employed in proportion to the horsepower as at former periods, there are fewer hands employed in proportion to the machinery. Footnote. Reports of Inspector of Factories for the 31st of October 1856. End of footnote. In the year 1850, the factories of the United Kingdom employed 134,217 nominal horsepower, to give motion to 25,638,716 spindles and 301,445 looms. The number of spindles and looms in 1856 was respectively 33,503,580 of the former and 369,205 of the latter, which, reckoning the force of the nominal horsepower required to be the same as in 1850, would require a force equal to 175,000 horses, but the actual power given in the return for 1856 is 161,435, less by above 10,000 horses than, calculating upon the basis of the return of 1850, the factories ought to have required in 1856. The facts thus brought out by the return of 1856 appear to be that the factory system is increasing rapidly, that although the same number of hands are employed in proportion to the horsepower as at former periods, there are fewer hands employed in proportion to the machinery, that the steam engine is enabled to drive an increased weight of machinery by economy of force and other methods, and that an increased quantity of work can be turned off by improvements in machinery, and in methods of manufacture, by increase of speed of the machinery, and by a variety of other causes. The great improvements made in machines of every kind have raised their productive power very much. Without any doubt, the shortening of the hours of labour gave the impulse to these improvements. The latter, combined with the more intense strain on the workman, have had the effect that at least as much is produced in the shortened, by 2 hours or 1/6, working day, as was previously produced during the longer one. One fact is sufficient to show how greatly the wealth of the manufacturers increased along with the more intense exploitation of labour power. From 1838 to 1850, the average proportional increase in English cotton and other factories was 32%, while from 1850 to 1856 it amounted to 86%. But however great the progress of English industry had been during the 8 years from 1848 to 1856 under the influence of a working day of 10 hours, it was far surpassed during the next period of 6 years, from 1856 to 1862. In silk factories, for instance, there were, in 1856, spindles 1,093,799. In 1862, 1,388,544. in 1856, looms, 9,260, in 1862, 10,709. But the number of operatives was, in 1856, 56,131, in 1862, 52,429. The increase in the spindles was therefore 26.9%, and in the looms, 15.6%, while the number of the operatives decreased 7%. In the year 1850, there were employed in Worsted Mills 875,830 spindles, in 1856, 1,324,549, increase 51.2%, and in 1862, 1,289,172, decrease 2.7%. But if we deduct the doubling spindles that figure in the numbers for 1856, but not in those for 1862, it will be found that after 1856, the number of spindles remained nearly stationary. On the other hand, after 1850, the speed of the spindles and looms was in many cases doubled. The number of power looms in Worsted Mills was, in 1850, 32,617, in 1856, 38,956, in 1862, 43,048. The number of operatives was, in 1850, 79,737, in 1856, 87,794, in 1862, 86,063. Included in these, however, the children under 14 years of age were, in 1850, 9,956, in 1856, 11,228, in 1862, 13,178. In spite, therefore, of the greatly increased number of looms in 1862 compared with 1856, the total number of the workpeople employed decreased, and that of the children exploited increased. Footnote. Reports of Inspector of Factories for 31st of October, 1862. End of footnote. On the 27th of April, 1863, Mr. Ferrand said in the House of Commons, "I have been informed by delegates from 16 districts of Lancashire and Cheshire, in whose behalf I speak, that the work in the factories is, in consequence of the improvements in machinery, constantly on the increase. Instead of, as formerly, one person with two helps tenting two looms, one person now tents three looms without helps, and it is no uncommon thing for one person to tent four. 12 hours' work, as is evident from the facts adduced, is now compressed into less than 10 hours. It is therefore self-evident to what an enormous extent the toil of the factory operative has increased during the last 10 years. Footnote. On two modern power looms, a weaver now makes in a week of 6 hours 26 pieces of certain quality, length and breadth, while on the old power looms he could make no more than 4 such pieces. The cost of weaving a piece of such cloth had already soon after 1850 fallen from 2 shillings and 9 pence to 5 shillings and 1/8 of a penny. 30 years ago, 1841, one spinner with 3 places was not required to attend to more than 1 pair of mules with 300 to 324 spindles. At the present time, 1871, he has to mind, with the help of 5 pieces, 2,200 spindles, and produces not less than 7 times as much yarn as in 1841. Alex Redgrave, Factory Inspector, in the Journal of Arts, 5th of January, 1872. End of footnote. Although, therefore, the factory inspectors unceasingly, and with justice, commend the results of the Acts of 1844 and 1850 yet they admit that the shortening of the hours of labour has already called forth such an intensification of the labour as is injurious to the health of the workman and to his capacity for work. In most of the cotton, worsted, and silk mills, an exhausting state of excitement necessary to enable the workers satisfactorily to mind the machinery, the motion of which has been greatly accelerated within the last few years, seems to me not unlikely to be one of the causes of that excess of mortality from lung disease which Dr. Greenhow has pointed out in his recent report on this subject. Footnote. Reports of Inspector of Factories for 31st of October 1861. There cannot be the slightest doubt that the tendency that urges capital, so soon as a prolongation of the hours of labour is once for all forbidden, to compensate itself by a systematic heightening of the intensity of labour and to convert every improvement in machinery into a more perfect means of exhausting the workman, must soon lead to a state of things in which a reduction of the hours of labour will again be inevitable. Footnote. The agitation for a working day of 8 hours has now, 1867, begun in Lancashire among the factory operatives. End of footnote. On the other hand, the rapid advance of English industry between 1848 and the present time, under the influence of a day of 10 hours, surpasses the advance made between 1833 and 1847, when the day was 12 hours long, by far more than the latter surpasses the advance made during the half-century after the first introduction of the factory system, when the working day was without limits. Footnote. The following few figures indicate the increase in the factories of the United Kingdom since 1848. In Lancashire, the number of mills increased only 4% between 1839 and 1850, 19% between 1850 and 1856, and 33% between 1856 and 1862, while the persons employed in them during each of the above periods of 11 years increased absolutely but diminished relatively. See Report of Inspector of Factories for 31st of October 1862. The cotton trade preponderates in Lancashire. We may form an idea of the stupendous nature of the cotton trade in that district when we consider that, of the gross number of textile factories in the United Kingdom, it absorbs 45.2%, of the spindles 83.3%, of the power looms 81.4%, of the mechanical horsepower 72.6%, and of the total number of persons employed 58.2%. End of footnote. Section 4. The Factory. At the commencement of this chapter, we considered that which we may call the body of the factory, that is, machinery organized into a system. We saw there how machinery, by annexing the labor of women and children, augments the number of human beings who form the material for capitalistic exploitation, how it confiscates the whole of the workman's disposable time by immoderate extension of the hours of labour, and how finally its progress, which allows of enormous increase of production in shorter and shorter periods, serves as a means of systematically getting more work done in a shorter time, or of exploiting labour power more intensely. We now turn to the factory as a whole, and that in its most perfect form. Dr. Ewer, the Pindar of the automatic factory, describes it on the one hand as combined cooperation of many orders of workpeople, adult and young, intending with assiduous skill a system of productive machines continuously impelled by a central power, the prime mover. On the other hand, as a vast automaton, composed of various mechanical and intellectual organs, acting in uninterrupted concert for the production of a common object, all of them being subordinate to a self-regulated moving force. These two descriptions are far from being identical. In one, the collective labourer, or social body of labour, appears as the dominant subject, and the mechanical automaton as the object. In the other, the automaton itself is the subject, and the workmen are merely conscious organs, coordinate with the unconscious organs of the automaton, and together with them, subordinated to the central moving power. The first description is applicable to every possible employment of machinery on a large scale. The second is characteristic of its use by capital, and therefore of the modern factory system. Ure prefers, therefore, to describe the central machine from which the motion comes, not only as an automaton, but as an autocrat. In these spacious halls, the benignant power of steam summons around him his myriads of willing menials. Along with the tool, the skill of the workman in handling it passes over to the machine. The capabilities of the tool are emancipated from the restraints that are inseparable from human labour power. Thereby, the technical foundation on which is based the division of labour in manufacture is swept away. Hence, in the place of the hierarchy of specialized workmen that characterizes manufacture, there steps in the automatic factory a tendency to equalize and reduce to one and the same level every kind of work that has to be done by the minders of the machines. In the place of the artificially produced differentiations of the detail workmen step the natural differences of age and sex. So far as division of labour reappears in the factory, it is primarily a distribution of the workmen among the specialised machines, and of masses of workmen, not however organised into groups, among the various departments of the factory, in each of which they work at a number of similar machines placed together. Their cooperation, therefore, is only simple. The organised group, peculiar to manufacture, is replaced by the connection between the head workman and his few assistants. The essential division is into workmen who are actually employed on the machines, among whom are included a few who look after the engine, and into mere attendants, almost exclusively children, of these workmen. Among the attendants are reckoned more or less all feeders who supply the machines with the material to be worked. In addition to these two principal classes, there is a numerically unimportant class of persons whose occupation it is to look after the whole of the machinery and repair it from time to time, such as engineers, mechanics, joiners, etc. This is a superior class of workmen, some of them scientifically educated, others brought up to a trade. It is distinct from the factory operative class and merely aggregated to it. Footnote. It looks very like intentional misleading by statistics, which misleading it would be possible to prove in detail in other cases too, when the English factory legislation excludes from its operation the class of labourers last mentioned in the text, while the parliamentary returns expressly include in the category of factory operatives not only engineers, mechanics, etc., but also managers, salesmen, messengers, warehousemen, packers, etc., in short, everybody, except the owner of the factory himself. End of footnote. This division of labour is purely technical. To work at a machine, the workman should be taught from childhood, in order that he may learn to adapt his own movements to the uniform and unceasing motion of an automaton. When the machinery, as a whole, forms a system of manifold machines, working simultaneously and in concert, the cooperation based upon it requires the distribution of various groups of workmen among the different kinds of machines. But the employment of machinery does away with the necessity of crystallizing this distribution after the manner of manufacture, by the constant annexation of a particular man to a particular function. Footnote. Ure grants this. He says, in case of need, the workman can be moved at the will of the manager from one machine to another, and he triumphantly exclaims, Such a change is in flat contradiction with the old routine that divides the labour, and to one workman assigns the task of fashioning the head of a needle, to another the sharpening of the point. He had much better have asked himself why this old routine is departed from in the automatic factory, only in case of need. End of footnote. Since the motion of the whole system does not proceed from the workman, but from the machinery, a change of persons can take place at any time without an interruption of the work. The most striking proof of this is afforded by the relays system, put into operation by the manufacturers during their revolt from 1848 to 1850. Lastly, the quickness with which machine work is learnt by young people does away with the necessity of bringing up for exclusive employment by machinery a special class of operatives. Footnote. When distress is very great, as for instance during the American Civil War, the factory operative is now and then set by the bourgeois to do the roughest of work, such as road-making, etc. The English Ateliers Nationaux, National Workshops of 1862 and the following years, established for the benefit of the destitute cotton operatives, differ from the French of 1848 in this, that in the latter the workmen had to do unproductive work at the expense of the state. In the former, they had to do productive municipal work to the advantage of the bourgeois, and that too cheaper than the regular workmen, with whom they were thus thrown into competition. The physical appearance of the cotton operatives is unquestionably improved. This I attribute, as to the men, to outdoor labour on public works. Reports of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1863. The writer here alludes to the Preston factory operatives, who were employed on Preston Moor. End of footnote. With regard to the work of the mere attendants, it can to some extent be replaced in the mill by machines, and owing to its extreme simplicity, it allows of a rapid and constant change of the individuals burdened with this drudgery. Footnote. An example. The various mechanical apparatus introduced since the Act of 1844 into woolen mills for replacing the labour of children. So soon as it shall happen that the children of the manufacturers themselves have to go through a course of schooling as helpers in the mill, this almost unexplored territory of mechanics will soon make remarkable progress. Of machinery, perhaps self-acting mules are as dangerous as any other kind. Most of the accidents from them happen to little children, from their creeping under the mules to sweep the floor while the mules are in motion. Several minders have been fined for this offence, but without much general benefit. If machine makers would only invent a self-sweeper, by whose use the necessity for these little children to creep under the machinery might be prevented, it would be a happy addition to our protective measures. Reports of Inspector of Factories for 31st of October, 1866. End of footnote. Although then, technically speaking, the old system of division of labour is thrown overboard by machinery, it hangs on in the factory as a traditional habit handed down from manufacture, and is afterwards systematically remoulded and established in a more hideous form by capital as a means of exploiting labour power. The lifelong speciality of handling one and the same tool now becomes the lifelong speciality of serving one and the same machine. Machinery is put to a wrong use, with the object of transforming the workman from his very childhood into a part of a detail machine. Footnote. So much then for Proudhon's wonderful idea. He construes machinery not as a synthesis of instruments of labour, but as a synthesis of detail operations for the benefit of the labourer himself. End of footnote. In this way, not only are the expenses of his reproduction considerably lessened, but at the same time his helpless dependence upon the factory as a whole, and therefore upon the capitalist, is rendered complete. Here, as everywhere else, we must distinguish between the increased productiveness due to the development of the social process of production and that due to the capitalist exploitation of that process. In handicrafts and manufacture, the workman makes use of a tool. In the factory, the machine makes use of him. There the movements of the instrument of labour proceed from him. Here it is the movements of the machine that he must follow. In manufacture, the workmen are parts of a living mechanism. In the factory, we have a lifeless mechanism independent of the workman, who becomes its mere living appendage. The miserable routine of endless drudgery and toil, in which the same mechanical process is gone through over and over again, is like the labour of Sisyphus. The burden of labour, like the rock, keeps ever falling back on the worn-out labourer. Footnote. Friedrich Engels. Even an ordinary and optimistic free trader, like Mr. Molinari, goes so far as to say, "A man becomes exhausted more quickly when he watches over the uniform motion of mechanism for 15 hours a day than when he applies his physical strength over the same period of time." This labour of surveillance, which might perhaps serve as a useful exercise for the mind if it did not go on too long, destroys both the mind and the body in the long run through excessive application. G. de Molinari, Études Économiques, Paris, 1846, end of footnote. At the same time that factory work exhausts the nervous system to the uttermost, it does away with the many-sided play of the muscles and confiscates every atom of freedom, both in bodily and intellectual activity. Footnote. Friedrich Engels, end of footnote. The lightening of the labour, even, becomes a sort of torture, since the machine does not free the labourer from work, but deprives the work of all interest. Every kind of capitalist production, in so far as it is not only a labour process, but also a process of creating surplus value, has this in common, that it is not the workman that employs the instruments of labour, but the instruments of labour that employ the workman. But it is only in the factory system that this inversion for the first time acquires technical and palpable reality. By means of its conversion into an automaton, the instrument of labour confronts the labourer during the labour process in the shape of capital, of dead labour, that dominates and pumps dry living labour power. The separation of the intellectual powers of production from the manual labour and the conversion of those powers into the might of capital over labour is, as we have already shown, finally completed by modern industry erected on the foundation of machinery. The special skill of each individual insignificant factory operative vanishes as an infinitesimal quantity before the science, the gigantic physical forces, and the mass of labour that are embodied in the factory mechanism and, together with that mechanism, constitute the power of the master. This master, therefore, in whose brain the machinery and his monopoly of it are inseparably united, whenever he falls out with his hands, contemptuously tells them, "The factory operatives should keep in wholesome remembrance the fact that theirs is really a low species of skilled labour, and that there is none which is more easily acquired, or of its quality more amply remunerated, or which by a short training of the least expert can be more quickly as well as abundantly acquired." The master's machinery really plays a far more important part in the business of production than the labour and the skill of the operative, which 6 months' education can teach, and a common labourer can learn. Footnote. The Master Spinners and Manufacturers Defence Fund, Report of the Committee, Manchester, 1854. We shall see hereafter that the master can sing quite another song when he is threatened with the loss of his living automaton. End of footnote. The technical subordination of the workman to the uniform motion of the instruments of labour and the peculiar composition of the body of work people, consisting as it does of individuals of both sexes and of all ages, give rise to a barrack discipline, which is elaborated into a complete system in the factory, and which fully develops the before-mentioned labour of overlooking, thereby dividing the work people into operatives and overlookers, into private soldiers and sergeants of an industrial army. The main difficulty in the automatic factory lay above all in training human beings to renounce their desultory habits of work and to identify themselves with the unvarying regularity of the complex automaton. To devise and administer a successful code of factory discipline suited to the necessities of factory diligence was the Herculean enterprise, the noble achievement of Arkwright. Even at the present day, when the system is perfectly organized and its labor lightened to the utmost, it is found nearly impossible to convert persons past the age of puberty into useful factory hands. Footnote. Ure, whoever knows the life history of Arkwright, will never dub this barber genius noble. Of all the great inventors of the 18th century, he was incontestably the greatest thiever of other people's inventions and the meanest fellow. End of footnote. The factory code, in which capital formulates, like a private legislator, and at his own goodwill, his autocracy over his workpeople, unaccompanied by that division of responsibility in other matters so much approved of by the bourgeoisie, and unaccompanied by the still more approved representative system, this code is but the capitalist caricature of that social regulation of the labour process which becomes requisite in cooperation on a great scale, and in the employment, in common, of instruments of labour and especially of machinery. The place of the slave driver's lash is taken by the overlooker's book of penalties. All punishments naturally resolve themselves into fines and deductions from wages, and the law-giving talent of the factory Lycurgus so arranges the matters that a violation of his laws is, if possible, more profitable to him than the keeping of them. Footnote. The slavery in which the bourgeoisie has bound the proletariat comes nowhere more plainly into daylight than in the factory system. In it, all freedom comes to an end, both at law and in fact. The workman must be in the factory at 5:30. If he come a few minutes late, he is punished. If he come 10 minutes late, he is not allowed to enter until after breakfast, and thus loses a quarter of a day's wage. He must eat, drink, and sleep at word of command. The despotic bell calls him from his bed, calls him from breakfast and dinner. And how does he fare in the mill? There the master is the absolute lawgiver. He makes what regulations he pleases. He alters and makes additions to his code at pleasure. And if he insert the veriest nonsense, the courts say to the workman, "Since you have entered into this contract voluntarily, you must now carry it out." These workmen are condemned to live, from their 9th year till their death, under this mental and bodily torture. Friedrich Engels. What the courts say, I will illustrate by 2 examples. One occurs at Sheffield at the end of 1866. In that town, a workman had engaged himself for 2 years in a steelworks. In consequence of a quarrel with his employer, he left the works and declared that under no circumstances would he work for that master any more. He was prosecuted for breach of contract and condemned to 2 months' imprisonment. If the master break the contract, he can be proceeded against only in a civil action, and risks nothing but money damages. After the workman has served his 2 months, the master invites him to return to the works, pursuant to the contract. Workman says, no, he has already been punished for the breach. The master prosecutes again, the court condemns again, although one of the judges, Mr. Shee, publicly denounces this as a legal monstrosity by which a man can periodically, as long as he lives, be punished over and over again for the same offence or crime. This judgment was given not by the great unpaid, the provincial Dogberries, but by one of the highest courts of justice in London. Added in the fourth German edition, this has now been done away with. With few exceptions, for example, when public gasworks are involved, the worker in England is now put on an equal footing with the employer in case of breach of contract and can be sued only civilly. Friedrich Engels. The second case occurs in Wiltshire at the end of November 1863. About 30 power loom weavers in the employment of one Harrop, a cloth manufacturer at Lewer's Mill, Westbury Lee, struck work because Master Harrop indulged in the agreeable habit of making deductions from their wages for being late in the morning. Sixpence for 2 minutes, 1 shilling for 3 minutes, and 1 and 6 pence for 10 minutes. This is at the rate of 9 shillings per hour and £4.10 per diem. While the wages of the weavers on the average of a year never exceeded 10 shillings to 12 shillings weekly. Harrop also appointed a boy to announce the starting time by a whistle, which he often did before 6 o'clock in the morning, and if the hands were not all there at the moment the whistle ceased, the doors were closed, and those hands who were outside were fined, and as there was no clock on the premises, the unfortunate hands were at the mercy of the young Harrop-inspired timekeeper. The hands on strike, mothers of families as well as girls, offered to resume work if the timekeeper were replaced by a clock and a more reasonable scale of fines were introduced. Harrop summoned 19 women and girls before the magistrates for breach of contract. To the utter indignation of all present, they were each mulcted in a fine of 6 pence and 2 and 6 pence for costs. Harrop was followed from the court by a crowd of people who hissed him. A favourite operation with manufacturers is to punish the workpeople by deductions made from their wages on account of faults in the material worked on. This method gave rise in 1866 to a general strike in the English pottery districts. The reports of the Children's Employment Commission, 1863 to 1866, give cases where the worker not only receives no wages, but becomes, by means of his labour and of the penal regulations, the debtor to boot of his worthy master. The late cotton crisis also furnished edifying examples of the sagacity shown by the factory autocrats in making deductions from wages. Mr. R. Baker, the inspector of factories, says, "I have myself had lately to direct prosecutions against one cotton mill occupier for having in these pinching and painful times deducted 10 pence apiece from some of the young workers employed by him for the surgeon's certificate, for which he himself had only paid 6 pence, when only allowed by the law to deduct 3 pence, and by custom nothing at all. And I have been informed of another who, in order to keep without the law but to attain the same object, charges the poor children who work for him 1 shilling each as a fee for learning them the art and mystery of cotton spinning, so soon as they are declared by the surgeon fit and proper persons for that occupation. There may, therefore, be undercurrent causes for such extraordinary exhibitions as strikes, not only wherever they arise, but particularly at such times as the present, which, without explanation, render them inexplicable to the public understanding." He alludes here to a strike of power loom weavers at Darwen, June 1863. Reports of Inspector of Factories for the 30th of April 1863. The reports always go beyond their official dates. End of footnote. We shall here merely allude to the material conditions under which factory labour is carried on. Every organ of sense is injured in an equal degree by artificial elevation of the temperature, by the dust-laden atmosphere, by the deafening noise, not to mention danger to life and limb among the thickly crowded machinery, which, with the regularity of the seasons, issues its list of the killed and wounded in the industrial battle. Footnote. The protection afforded by the Factory Acts against dangerous machinery has had a beneficial effect. But there are other sources of accident which did not exist 20 years since, one especially, viz. The increased speed of the machinery. Wheels, rollers, spindles and shuttles are now propelled at increased and increasing rates. Fingers must be quicker and defter in their movements to take up the broken thread, for, if placed with hesitation or carelessness, they are sacrificed. A large number of accidents are caused by the eagerness of the workpeople to get through their work expeditiously. It must be remembered that it is of the highest importance to manufacturers that their machinery should be in motion, that is, producing yarns and goods. Every minute's stoppage is not only a loss of power, but of production. And the workpeople are urged by the overlookers, who are interested in the quantity of work turned off, to keep the machinery in motion, and it is no less important to those of the operatives who are paid by the weight or piece that the machines should be kept in motion. Consequently, although it is strictly forbidden in many, nay, in most factories, that machinery should be cleaned while in motion, it is nevertheless the constant practice in most, if not all, that the workpeople do, unreproved, pick out waste, wipe rollers and wheels, etc., while their frames are in motion. Thus, from this cause only, 906 accidents have occurred during the 6 months. Although a great deal of cleaning is constantly going on day by day, yet Saturday is generally the day set apart for the thorough cleaning of the machinery, and a great deal of this is done while the machinery is in motion. Since cleaning is not paid for, the workpeople seek to get done with it as speedily as possible. Hence, the number of accidents which occur on Fridays, and especially on Saturdays, is much larger than on any other day. On the former day, the excess is nearly 12% over the average number of the 4 first days of the week, and on the latter day the excess is 25% over the average of the preceding 5 days, or, if the number of working hours on Saturday being taken into account, 7.5 hours on Saturday as compared with 10.5 on other days, there is an excess of 65% on Saturdays over the average of the other 5 days. Reports of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1866. End of footnote. Economy of the social means of production, matured and forced as in a hothouse by the factory system, is turned in the hands of capital into systematic robbery of what is necessary for the life of the workman while he is at work. Robbery of space, light, air, and of protection to his person against the dangerous and unwholesome accompaniments of the productive process, not to mention the robbery of appliances for the comfort of the workman. Footnote. In Part 1 of Book 3, I shall give an account of a recent campaign by the English manufacturers against the clauses in the Factory Acts that protect the hands against dangerous machinery. For the present, let this one quotation from the official report of Leonard Horner suffice. I have heard some mill owners speak with inexcusable levity of some of the accidents, such, for instance, as the loss of a finger being a trifling matter. A working man's living and prospects depend so much upon his fingers that any loss of them is a very serious matter to him. When I have heard such inconsiderate remarks made, I have usually put this question. Suppose you were in want of an additional workman, and two were to apply, both equally and well qualified in other respects, but one had lost a thumb or a forefinger, which would you engage? There never was a hesitation as to the answer. The manufacturers have mistaken prejudices against what they have heard represented as a pseudo-philanthropic legislation. Reports of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1855. These manufacturers are clever folk, and not without reason were they enthusiastic for the slaveholders' rebellion. End of footnote. Is Fourier wrong when he calls factories tempered bagnos? Footnote. In those factories that have been longest subject to the factory acts, with their compulsory limitation of the hours of labour and other regulations, many of the older abuses have vanished. The very improvement of the machinery demands, to a certain extent, improved construction of the buildings, and this is an advantage to the workpeople. See Reports of Inspector of Factories for the 31st of October, 1863. End of footnote. Section 5. The Strife Between Workman and Machine. The contest between the capitalist and the wage labourer dates back to the very origin of capital. It raged on throughout the whole manufacturing period. Footnote. See, amongst others, John Houghton, Husbandry and Trade Improved, London, 1727. The Advantages of the East India Trade, 1720, John Bellars. The masters and their workmen are, unhappily, in a perpetual war with each other. The invariable object of the former is to get their work done as cheaply as possible, and they do not fail to employ every artifice to this purpose, whilst the latter are equally attentive to every occasion of distressing their masters into a compliance with higher demands. An inquiry into the causes of the present high price of provisions. Author, the Reverend Nathaniel Forster, quite on the side of the workmen. End of footnote. But only since the introduction of machinery has the workman fought against the instrument of labour itself, the material embodiment of capital. He revolts against this particular form of the means of production as being the material basis of the capitalist mode of production. In the 17th century, nearly all Europe experienced revolts of the workpeople against the ribbon loom, a machine for weaving ribbons and trimmings, called in Germany Bandmühle, Schnurmühle, and Mühlenstuhl. These machines were invented in Germany. Abbé Lancelotti, in a work that appeared in Venice in 1636, but which was written in 1579, says as follows. Antony Müller of Danzig saw about 50 years ago in that town a very ingenious machine which weaves 4 to 6 pieces at once. But the mayor, being apprehensive that this invention might throw a large number of workmen on the streets, caused the inventor to be secretly strangled or drowned. In Leiden, this machine was not used till 1629. There, the riots of the ribbon weavers at length compelled the town council to prohibit it. In this town, says Boxhorn, Institute of Politics, 1663, referring to the introduction of this machine into Leiden, about 20 years ago certain people invented an instrument for weaving with which a single person could weave more cloth and more easily than many others in the same length of time. As a result, there arose disturbances and complaints from the weavers, until the town council finally prohibited the use of this instrument. After making various decrees more or less prohibitive against this loom in 1632, 1639, etc., the States General of Holland at length permitted it to be used under certain conditions by the decree of the 15th of December, 1661. It was also prohibited in Cologne in 1676, at the same time that its introduction into England was causing disturbances among the workpeople. By an imperial edict of 19th of February, 1685, its use was forbidden throughout all Germany. In Hamburg it was burnt in public by order of the Senate. The Emperor Charles VI, on the 9th of February, 1719, renewed the edict of 1685, and not till 1765 was its use openly allowed in the electorate of Saxony. This machine, which shook Europe to its foundations, was in fact the precursor of the mule and the power loom, and of the industrial revolution of the 18th century. It enabled a totally inexperienced boy to set the whole loom with all its shuttles in motion, by simply moving a rod backwards and forwards, and in its improved form produced from 40 to 50 pieces at once. About 1630, a wind sawmill, erected near London by a Dutchman, succumbed to the excesses of the populace. Even as late as the beginning of the 18th century, sawmills driven by water overcame the opposition of the people, supported as it was by Parliament, only with great difficulty. No sooner had Everett, in 1758, erected the first wool-shearing machine that was driven by water power than it was set on fire by 100,000 people who had been thrown out of work. 50,000 workpeople, who had previously lived by carding wool, petitioned Parliament against Arkwright's scribbling mills and carding engines. The enormous destruction of machinery that occurred in the English manufacturing districts during the first 15 years of this century, chiefly caused by the employment of the power loom and known as the Luddite movement, gave the anti-Jacobin governments of a Sidmouth, a Castlereagh, and the like a pretext for the most reactionary and forcible measures. It took both time and experience before the workpeople learned to distinguish between machinery and its employment by capital, and to direct their attacks not against the material instruments of production, but against the mode in which they are used. Footnote. In old-fashioned manufactures, the revolts of the workpeople against machinery, even to this day, occasionally assume a savage character, as in the case of the Sheffield file cutters in 1865. End of footnote. The contests about wages in manufacture presuppose manufacture and are in no sense directed against its existence. The opposition against the establishment of new manufactures proceeds from the guilds and privileged towns, not from the workpeople. Hence, the writers of the manufacturing period treat the division of labour chiefly as a means of virtually supplying a deficiency of labourers, not as a means of actually displacing those in work. This distinction is self-evident. If it be said that 100 millions of people would be required in England to spin with the old spinning wheel the cotton that is now spun with mules by 500,000 people, this does not mean that the mules took the place of those millions who never existed. It means only this, that many millions of workpeople would be required to replace the spinning machinery. If, on the other hand, we say that in England the power loom threw 800,000 weavers on the streets, we do not refer to existing machinery that would have to be replaced by a definite number of workpeople, but to a number of weavers in existence who were actually replaced or displaced by the looms. During the manufacturing period, handicraft labour, altered though it was by division of labour, was yet the basis. The demands of the new colonial markets could not be satisfied owing to the relatively small number of town operatives handed down from the Middle Ages, and the manufacturers proper opened out new fields of production to the rural population, driven from the land by the dissolution of the feudal system. At that time, therefore, division of labour and cooperation in the workshops were viewed more from the positive aspect, that they made the workpeople more productive. Footnote. Sir James Stewart also understands machinery quite in this sense. More naive is Petty, who says it replaces polygamy. This point of view is, at the most, admissible only for some parts of the United States. On the other hand, machinery can seldom be used with success to abridge the labour of an individual. More time would be lost in its construction than could be saved by its application. It is only really useful when it acts on great masses, when a single machine can assist the work of thousands. It is accordingly in the most populous countries, where there are most idle men, that it is most abundant. It is not called into use by a scarcity of men, but by the facility with which they can be brought to work in masses. Percy Ravenstone, Thoughts on the Funding System and Its Effects, London, 1824. End of footnote. Long before the period of modern industry, cooperation and the concentration of the instruments of labour in the hands of a few gave rise in numerous countries where these methods were applied in agriculture to great, sudden and forcible revolutions in the modes of production, and consequentially in the conditions of existence and the means of employment of the rural populations. But this contest at first takes place more between the large and the small landed proprietors than between capital and wage labour. On the other hand, when the labourers are displaced by the instruments of labour, by sheep, horses, etc., in this case force is directly resorted to in the first instance as the prelude to the Industrial Revolution. The labourers are first driven from the land, and then come the sheep. Land grabbing on a great scale, such as was perpetrated in England, is the first step in creating a field for the establishment of agriculture on a great scale. Footnote. Note in the fourth German edition. This applies to Germany too. Where in our country agriculture on a large scale exists, hence particularly in the East, it has become possible only in consequence of the clearing of the estates, Bauernlegen, a practice which became wider spread in the 16th century and was particularly so since 1648. Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. Hence this subversion of agriculture puts on at first more the appearance of a political revolution. The instrument of labour, when it takes the form of a machine, immediately becomes a competitor of the workman himself. Footnote. Machinery and labour are in constant competition. Ricardo. End of footnote. The self-expansion of capital by means of machinery is thenceforward directly proportional to the number of the workpeople whose means of livelihood have been destroyed by that machinery. The whole system of capitalist production is based on the fact that the workman sells his labour power as a commodity. Division of labour specialises this labour power by reducing it to skill in handling a particular tool. So soon as the handling of this tool becomes the work of a machine, then with the use value, the exchange value too of the workman's labour power vanishes. The workman becomes unsaleable, like paper money thrown out of currency by legal enactment. That portion of the working class, thus by machinery rendered superfluous, that is, no longer immediately necessary for the self-expansion of capital, either goes to the wall in the unequal contest of the old handicrafts and manufactures with machinery, or else floods all the more easily accessible branches of industry, swamps the labour market, and sinks the price of labour power below its value. It is impressed upon the workpeople as a great consolation, first that their sufferings are only temporary, a temporary inconvenience, secondly, that machinery acquires the mastery over the whole of a given field of production only by degrees, so that the extent and intensity of its destructive effect is diminished. The first consolation neutralizes the second. When machinery seizes on an industry by degrees, it produces chronic misery among the operatives who compete with it. Where the transition is rapid, the effect is acute and felt by great masses. History discloses no tragedy more horrible than the gradual extinction of the English handloom weavers, an extinction that was spread over several decades and finally sealed in 1838. Many of them died of starvation, many with families vegetated for a long time on tuppence halfpenny a day. Footnote. The competition between hand-weaving and power-weaving in England before the passing of the Poor Law of 1833 was prolonged by supplementing the wages, which had fallen considerably below the minimum, with parish relief. The Reverend Mr. Turner was, in 1827, rector of Wilmslow in Cheshire, a manufacturing district. The questions of the Committee of Emigration and Mr. Turner's answers show how the competition of human labour is maintained against machinery. Question. Has not the use of the power loom superseded the use of the hand loom? Answer. Undoubtedly. It would have superseded them much more than it has done if the hand loom weavers were not enabled to submit to a reduction of wages. Question. But in submitting, he has accepted wages which are insufficient to support him, and looks to parochial contributions as the remainder of his support? Answer. Yes. And in fact the competition between the hand loom and the power loom is maintained out of the poor rates. Thus, degrading pauperism or expatriation is the benefit which the industrious receive from the introduction of machinery, to be reduced from the respectable and in some degree independent mechanic to the cringing wretch who lives on the debasing bread of charity. This they call a temporary inconvenience. A prize essay on the comparative merits of competition and cooperation, 1834, end of footnote. On the other hand, the English cotton machinery produced an acute effect in India. The Governor-General reported